What Carrie invited Sarah and I to cover today was a little bit about the kind of nuts and bolts of the human rights complaint process, and to have a look at what the actual form looks like if you were to make a human rights complaint at the BC Human Rights Tribunal, which we've been talking a lot about, but we haven't actually looked at what does the piece of paper look like? What does the form look like? What kind of information do you put in the form and where? And just how does that work to get a complaint started? I hope you won't take this last session to mean that making a human rights complaint is always the best solution or that it's the place to start. I think Sarah, especially last time, made some really good points about ways of trying to solve a problem that you may be experiencing with an employer or a service provider in a way that doesn't require you to launch a formal human rights complaint. And we talked about problem solving. You'll recall that not yet award-winning, but certainly I'm sure it's coming. Role play, the incredible acting skills that were on display there, around how you might have a conversation, perhaps a difficult conversation with an employer about needs for accommodations you may have. But the human rights complaint process, I guess I think of it as sort of the backstop, right? This is where you go when other alternatives haven't worked or aren't going to work, and you need to have some independent decision maker decide that what happened was discriminatory and give you some remedy, some compensation for what happened to you. So what I thought we would do, and the other piece that Carrie and Denzel asked us to cover today, in addition to kind of walking through the complaint form, was to talk about some of the resources that are out there that might help you, help support you in that process of making a human rights complaint, or just answer other legal questions or provide advocacy on various issues that might be coming up that you may or may not be aware of. So I've given you the document that we use at CLASS, the Community Legal Assistance Society where I work, because we're not able to help everyone with the issues that they come to us with. We have particular areas that we work in, and even within those areas, the demand almost always outstrips our capacity to supply support and services. So we do find ourselves sometimes referring people to other places for help. And so that's the document that we use to try to figure out where the most appropriate place to refer folks might be. So I hope that that resource list will be as useful to you as it is to us. And I'll talk about a few of the kind of what seemed to me at least as the key resources that I think might be most helpful and relevant to this group. Sarah will be arriving shortly, and what she's going to focus on is one of the stages in the human rights complaint process called the early settlement meeting process, which is a really, really important part of a human rights complaint process. And she's going to tell you more about what happens in an early settlement meeting and why it might be useful and helpful, and how, if you were going through a human rights complaint process, you might prepare for that, get ready for that, things to think about, and so forth. But what I'm going to do is just walk us through a little bit the complaint form and the kinds of things that you should be thinking about if you found yourself filling out a complaint form for yourself or potentially helping somebody else to file a complaint form because you've identified that there is a discrimination issue, a failure to accommodate issue that hasn't been resolved in any other way. What I've got up here on the screen is the BC Human Rights Tribunal's website. Does anyone remember what the BC Human Rights Tribunal is and does? Exactly. The Human Rights Tribunal is like the court that deals with human rights complaints. So they're looking at the cases, the complaints that get filed by people who believe that they have been discriminated against, and they make legal decisions. They hold hearings and make decisions about whether or not discrimination happened. And if they find that yes, discrimination did happen, they can order what are called remedies for that discrimination. They can make an order for compensation, make an order that the employer stop doing whatever it was that they were doing that was discriminatory, and enforce those orders as well, just like a judge can in court. And so the tribunal really deals with the whole legal process. And you can go to the Human Rights Tribunal's website here. And for folks that might be listening, the website is www.bchrt.bc.ca. And it's a really useful resource in a lot of ways. It's a pretty good website. And the place that I'm going to direct you to is over here on the right of the screen, the tab called Law Library. And you can see when I put my cursor on top of Law Library, a bunch of things drop down. We could look at the legislation. That would be the Human Rights Code that governs these human rights and discrimination issues. We could look at the rules for using the tribunals. Processes. We could look at practice directions, things that the tribunal has said to people who are using its services about how they should engage. But where I would like to take you for now is to the forms button. This is where, if I click that, this is where you will find the form you need in order to start a human rights complaint. You can see under the heading File a Complaint, you have four options. File your own complaint, file a complaint for another person, file a complaint for a group or class of persons, or file a retaliation complaint. If someone has an employer, for example, has punished you for filing an initial complaint, you might file a retaliation complaint. But most of the time, you will be looking to file your own complaint. And you can, of course, have somebody help you with that. Doesn't mean you have to do it all on your own, but filing your own complaint is what most of the time people are doing. So when I click that, the form opens up. You can see it's a 20-page document, which is why I didn't print copies for everyone. Thought we would save some trees, and just have a look at the form here on the screen. And of course, you can look at it if you have a computer at home. You can take a look. And I've also copied a few bits of the form into the PowerPoint slides that you have. So you can also look at some of the form there. And what you can see here on the first page is that you fill out your information on the first page. Notice here there's a checkbox and it says, check here to tell the tribunal not to disclose the additional contact information below to the respondent. So if you make a human rights complaint, the person or company that you're complaining about that you think has discriminated against you, you have to provide them with information about your address and your name so that they can send you their response. And so you can both be participating in the legal process. But you don't have to give them your phone number or your email address if you're not comfortable with that. They need to know your address so they can mail you things. But if you check that box, you can give your phone number and your email address to the tribunal, which can be really helpful so you can have conversations with folks at the tribunal, but maybe you don't want the respondent having that information. And so that gives you the option to keep that part of your contact information private. After you fill out your own information, the next step is to name the respondents. Who is your complaint about? And one of the things I kind of like about this form from the tribunal is that every other page is an information page. So this is an information page here that's providing you with information about how to name the respondent. And what's cool is if you print this document out double-sided, it'll always be on the back of the page. As you turn over the next page, you'll see an information page right there, and the page you have to fill out will be in front of you, and you can kind of consult the information page at the same time as you're filling out the page that you're supposed to fill out. So this is a page that I did not copy on this slide, but I did want to say just a couple of words. Sorry, this is going back back one of the slides to whether you would make an individual complaint or a group complaint or a class complaint. We've talked about this briefly before, and as I just mentioned a moment ago, most of the time you're bringing an individual complaint. Although, if you want, you can have someone bring that complaint on your behalf. Sometimes with kids, with youth, a complaint is brought by their parent rather than by themselves on their own behalf. And it's also possible for an adult to bring a complaint on behalf of another adult if they have the consent of that person, or if that person doesn't have capacity to bring the complaint themselves. Group complaints are when the same kind of thing is happening to a group of people at the workplace. For example, a group of women are experiencing harassment on the job. They might bring a group complaint. And a class complaint is where a big category of people are being discriminated against on the basis of some characteristic that they all share. And I think I told you about a case that we're working on right now in my office where deaf people have made a complaint against the St. John's Ambulance Society for not providing sign language interpreters at their first aid trainings. And they've brought this complaint as a class complaint because this issue has probably affected lots of people across BC, and we want everybody to get the benefit of what we hope will be a successful decision. So we're a long way away from that stage at this point. So that's what a class complaint is. And you've probably heard of class actions before in the past. So looking back to the form, we're on the page about naming the respondents. And we've talked a little bit about who can be a respondent in a human rights case. We know that employers, landlords, business owners, government ministries, other service providers can all potentially be respondents in a human rights case. And in some cases, an individual might also be a respondent in a human rights case, but it really depends on whether they are just doing their job and acting in accordance with their job duties, or if they're doing something where they really are sort of personally responsible for what they're doing. They're acting outside of the duties of their job. And a classic example of that is harassment. A coworker or a supervisor who's engaging in harassment is not just doing their job, they are acting outside of their job duties. And in those cases, it's probably right that they should be named as an individual respondent in that case. But the general rule is that it's the company, the employer, who's responsible for discrimination. It's their job to provide a discrimination-free workplace, and they are held liable for the actions of their employees under the Human Rights Code. So I'm just going to go back and forth a little bit just so you can see the form. This is what it looks like for where you have to fill in the respondent. And it gives you space for three respondents, number one, and then two and three, if applicable. And you would fill in the name of the company, or if you've decided it seems appropriate that an individual should be named as well, you would fill in their name as well. The relationship to you. Company was your employer, person was your supervisor, whatever that relationship happens to be, and then the contact information for the company. If you don't know that information, it is possible to do what's called a corporate search of that information for that information. If you need to do that, you might want to reach out to one of the resources that we're going to talk about later in the presentation. But if you worked at the place that you're making a complaint about, even if you went for an interview but didn't actually work there, provided you can provide some mailing address so that the complaint can be sent to them once you've filed it with the tribunal, you should be able to kind of sort out those details without too much trouble. Just send it to the attention of the company and leave it to them to get it to the employee. As we have talked about in previous sessions, we are protected from discrimination in particular areas of our lives, including in our employment, on the job, in accommodation, services, and facilities that are publicly available. We're protected from discrimination in tenancy. And then these last three come up a lot less frequently, but in our membership in a union or other occupational association, in our purchase of property, and with respect to publications. But we've been really mainly focused on the employment context. Publications means things that are published, so not just a private conversation, that are either discriminatory or potentially hateful, hate speech. So a poster, a pamphlet, something like that, a sign, an ad in a newspaper. And as we saw on that previous page, we're back on an info page on the form. So this would be the back of the page as you flip it over, where you get some instructions about the different areas of protection. So what is meant by employment? That's about work at a job. It reminds us that volunteer jobs can be included, and it reminds us that employment covers all parts of work, right from the very beginning of the employment relationship, even before an employment relationship, a job ad, the interview process, a hiring decision, firing, wages, benefits, the work environment, the terms and conditions of the job. All of those things are included in employment. So just again to reiterate that there's lots of great information right in the complaint form itself to help kind of guide you through and provide information as you may be going through the complaint form. So step two is where you identify the areas of discrimination, whether it's employment or services or tenancy or maybe a couple of areas. Maybe it's employment and publications, as Sarah mentioned. And it may be the case, I don't think I've seen this before, but where the areas of discrimination are different for the different respondents that you are naming. Can you think of an example of where that might come up? They would usually be the same. Yeah. I think it would be most common that you're making a complaint about one area of discrimination, but that is probably the most common exception to that, where there's a union complaint as well. So again, there's space for you to name the area of discrimination for three respondents, but you shouldn't feel bound to just stick to this form. If you need to attach additional pages, you're totally allowed to do that. There are places throughout the form where it tells you, oh, if you've attached additional pages, just check this box. So you're completely okay to do that if you need more space, or if you have more than three respondents that you're naming, it's perfectly acceptable for you to write them out on a separate piece of paper. Next, we get into the grounds of discrimination. We've looked at these in a bit of detail and then done more of a deeper dive into a couple of them. We've looked more in depth at what's meant by physical disability and mental disability. And again, more than one of these grounds may be relevant to your complaint. Maybe you think that the way you were treated had to do with your disability, but also with your gender. Or maybe it had to do with your age in addition to your race for example. It's not necessarily one thing or the other. Sometimes there are more than one prohibited grounds of discrimination at play in a complaint. And again, the info page in the form explains what's meant by the various grounds of discrimination. Pretty briefly, I will be honest, that's not a ton of information about what is meant by physical disability. But as we know from our previous sessions, physical disability is interpreted to include a fairly broad range of conditions that are seen to affect a person's capacities or abilities to participate in the workforce. So there's no kind of list of what counts as a disability. It is fairly broad. So here is the part of the form where you would fill in what grounds of discrimination you believe are at play in your complaint. And you can see it's not very much space at all. So you're not telling the whole story at this stage. You're really just listing the grounds. You would pop into that square, whatever grounds they were, physical disability, and then a brief description. You can see here that the example that they use for disability is, I have asthma. So just naming what the disability is, or race, naming what your race is. You don't have to say what happened to you yet at this point. Do that in a minute. You just name what are the grounds of discrimination that you believe are at play. And you can do that for, again, all three respondents. And then you move on to the part of the form, which is where you tell the story and explain what happened. And as you may recall, to prove discrimination, you have to make three main points to make out your case. And they're listed here right on the form. What did the respondent do? What was the adverse impact or the negative impact on you? And how was that ground of discrimination that you just named on that last page, how was it connected to the negative thing that happened to you? Why do you believe that your disability or your gender or whatever the ground is that you've named, why do you believe that that was connected to the negative thing that happened to you? And as I think I've mentioned, that tends to be the hardest part of a human rights complaint to prove. It can be tricky sometimes to show that that connection was present. But bear in mind that at this stage, you're just telling the story. You're just making your statement about what happened. And so you don't have to prove it at this stage. That comes much later when the case is being heard by the Human Rights Tribunal. At this stage, you just want to show that there's some reason to believe that your disability or your sex or whatever the ground is, some reason to believe that it's connected to the negative thing that happened. So those are the three questions that the form asks, and then it provides you space to answer them. Respondent 1's conduct. What did Respondent 1 do? What was the negative impact on you? And how was that characteristic, that ground of discrimination, a factor in the negative thing that happened? Why do you believe that they are connected?
This is where I see a lot of people come to me for advice after they filed the complaint. And maybe it's been sent back to them by the tribunal because it doesn't have the enough information in it or the right information in it. And so how was the ground of discrimination a factor in the adverse impact is usually the problem. So they'll say, I was fired. I have a disability. That's not a human rights complaint. You need to be able to say, I was fired because I have a disability. And here's how I know that. So you have to put at least some information. You can't just say you have a protected ground and something bad happened to you. You have to be able to write on the form what the connection was between the two things. And that's a really important piece of it that gets missed. I think sometimes people will just put the same information in. I have a disability. I was fired. How was it a factor? I was fired because I had a disability. Well, you need to put a little bit more in it than that to be able to show you have some connection. So you have some basis for believing that your disability was the reason you were fired. And so that is what you're going to put in there. For example, my supervisor made negative comments about my disability to me while I was employed there. I was fired because of performance, but the reason I couldn't perform to the standard they wanted was because of my disability. So you have to put those kinds of connections in. So it can be comments, it can be standards that were set that you couldn't meet. And it's important to write in what those are. Does that answer your question?
And you may not always have clear, concrete evidence that your disability or other protected characteristic was the reason for the negative treatment. When you have statements or something clear like that, that can make it much easier to prove the case. But sometimes you're having to convince the tribunal, persuade the tribunal that they should draw an inference between your termination or whatever the negative thing is and your disability. And so that might look like the timing of the situation. For example, your allergies flared up really badly one day and you had to go home early, and the next day you got fired. Maybe there's not a clear statement from the employer that was related to your disability, but the timing makes you fairly certain that your disability was a factor in what happened. So whatever makes you believe that it was your disability that was a factor, that's what you're going to put into that box. So the question is, could a person with a disability be a respondent in a human rights complaint? Could the person who you believe discriminated against you maybe also be a person with a disability? Is that, am I characterizing your question right? Yeah. Yes. Yes, they could. They could. A person with a disability may be a person who has engaged in discriminatory conduct. If their conduct had a negative effect on you and was based on your disability or some other protected characteristic, then potentially that person has engaged in discrimination. Remember a couple of slides ago when we talked, and also a couple weeks ago, and maybe you weren't here for that one, when we talked about whether an individual should be named as a respondent in a human rights complaint or whether it should just be the company. And it really depends whether the person was kind of just doing their job and maybe they carried out an order that was ended up being found to be discriminatory, like the person who called you to tell you that you were fired. Would they be an individual you would name as a respondent in a human rights complaint? Probably not, because the company is ultimately responsible for discrimination. Not your fellow employee, but it could be a supervisor or your immediate manager. So just to come back to the form, I just want to point you here to this little checkbox here that I was referring to earlier. This is a place where you might find there's just not enough room in this one page to adequately explain what happened to you. So you might decide to just check this box and ask the tribunal to consider your story as you've written it in a separate document. And I also just want to note the way that this is structured here. What did respondent number one do? It's structured like a chronology. You have a date column where it asks you to fill in the date of what happened and then space for you to explain what happened. And I don't know if you find this too, Sarah, I find this a really nice way to organize my thoughts and to organize the story in a chronological way. And of course, if you don't remember exact dates when something happened, that's okay. It's okay to just put the month and the year, if you remember that, or say like around this time, this is what happened. Ideally, if you remember the exact date of things that happened, particularly the really significant things, like if you were terminated, for example, or experienced a discriminatory comment on the job and remember when that happened, it's great to put that level of detail if you can. But if you don't remember, you can just provide as much detail as you do remember. And again, there's space for you to do that for up to 3 respondents, but of course you can attach more if you need to. There's just a couple more parts of the form. You can see that we're at page 12 of 20. And for many complaints, that's going to be pretty much all you have to do. Tell the story, explain what happened, and why you believe one of the protected characteristics from the Human Rights Code was a factor in what happened to you. The form does ask you about whether the event that you're claiming was discriminatory happened within the last 6 months. And you may remember that the tribunal has a pretty strict 6-month deadline for filing. Their limitation period is 6 months, and you're supposed to get your complaint in within 6 months of the event happening to you. And so if the conduct that you're making your human rights complaint about happened within the last 6 months, you check yes, and you move on to the next section. But if you check no, they want a little bit more information. If some of or all of the conduct that you believe was discriminatory happened outside of the 6-month timeline, all is not necessarily lost. It still may be possible to submit your human rights complaint and have it decided on, but you will have to explain why there was a delay in getting the complaint in. And you may also be able to persuade the tribunal to accept the complaint on the basis that it's what's called a continuing contravention. Ooh, that's bright. So sometimes discrimination is one event. One thing happens, a discriminatory comment, or you're terminated. But sometimes discrimination happens over a period of time or is repeated again and again. Harassment being maybe a good example of that, where somebody is making sexist comments or comments related to your disability over a repeated in a repeated way over a period of time. And some of those comments might have been made within the last 6 months, but some of them might have happened longer ago. So you want to show the tribunal that those events are pretty similar and are about the same respondent, the same person or people at the same workplace are making those comments. And for that reason, the tribunal should consider all of them, even the ones that happened outside of 6 months. That's one example of a continuing contravention. There's also sometimes a situation where there's an ongoing state of affairs, like there's a policy at the workplace that has a discriminatory impact, or the workplace doesn't have accessibility measures in place, doesn't have a ramp, or doesn't have other accessibility measures to meet your needs. And in that kind of a situation, again, there's not one event that you're making a complaint about. It's an ongoing state of affairs. And so in that kind of situation, it may be possible to bring in older things that happened. But even if neither of those situations apply, even if you can't say it was a continuing contravention and it happened more than 6 months ago, there's still some chance that you could make the complaint. Because the tribunal has what's called discretion. They have the option, if they think it's appropriate, if they think it's in the public interest, they can also accept late complaints in those situations. But they're going to weigh out the balance and make a decision. And they don't let too many complaints in on that basis, that they think it's in the public interest to let it in. But they'll look at the reason why you were late in filing the complaint, why you weren't able to get the complaint in 6 months. And certainly if you've had an illness or your disability has prevented you from even being able to
you know, get to a computer and work through a complaint form. That could be a good reason that the tribunal might accept to accept a late filed complaint. They'll also look at how late it is, like if it's just a couple weeks past the 6-month deadline, much greater likelihood that it'll get accepted compared to if it's like a year late, then it's going to be pretty difficult to get the complaint accepted. So they'll look at those things as well. They'll also look at whether your complaint raises like really important new legal issues that haven't been decided by the tribunal before. That's also something the tribunal might consider in deciding whether to accept a late filed complaint. But I mean, best option is to file your complaint quickly and get it in before the 6 months elapses. Then you don't have to deal with any of that and just get to check that box and move on to the next section of the form. But if your complaint is past the 6 months, I wouldn't want to say, oh, don't even bother filing it, because there may be some way to kind of work around that time limit. There was some exciting human rights news a couple of weeks ago. The government is reinstating the Human Rights Commission. We used to have a Human Rights Commission, but haven't had one for quite a long time. We've been the only province without a Human Rights Commission for about 16 years now. And the government is reestablishing our Human Rights Commission, which I think is great news. And what they're also doing with their proposal for the Human Rights Commission is extending the time limit to a year. It used to be a year, and then it got shortened to 6 months. And so the proposal is to bring it back to the 1 year limitation period that it used to be. So this may change. This information may be outdated in a couple of months and may give folks a full year to make their complaint. So stay tuned for that news. But for now, we are at the 6 months.
It does go fast, and it's a lot, right, to prepare for a case, to prepare to file a human rights complaint. And I think a lot of people do want to work it out in other ways. As you say, their first response isn't to start a case, start a complaint. Their first response maybe is to try to work with the employer, try to figure things out. Maybe they're using another system, like a grievance process with their union or some other legal process, and don't want to have two things in the air at the same time. Lots of barriers to speaking up for ourselves and taking this, what feels like, I don't know, feels to me, and I work with people that are doing it every day, but it still feels to me like a really drastic step to file a human rights complaint, for sure. Step 5 of the complaint process or the complaint form is to let the tribunal know if you have started any other legal proceedings, if you have a union grievance that's going through, or you've made a complaint to the Employment Standards Tribunal. The Human Rights Tribunal wants to know about that. Sometimes they will, what's called, defer a human rights complaint while those other processes go along. I won't spend too much time talking about that. It doesn't come up too much, but they don't want to duplicate and have two bodies looking at the same thing and maybe making contradictory decisions. They'll usually look at which one is going to be faster, and they'll want to know whether the other process is going to deal with the human rights issues. Some processes can't deal with human rights issues, like Employment Standards doesn't deal with human rights. So they wouldn't likely defer your human rights complaint because you have an Employment Standards case going, but they do want to know if there are other proceedings going along. And then the last thing that you fill out on the human rights complaint form, is step 6, the remedies that you're looking for. What kind of solution, what kind of compensation do you want to see come out of this human rights complaint? And so these are some of the things that the tribunal can order
at the end of a human rights complaint, if they agree with you that, yes, you were discriminated against, they can order the discrimination to stop. They can make a statement that what happened was discriminatory, and they can order the respondent not to engage in that kind of behavior in the future. And then they can award compensation. If you were fired, you might be entitled to lost wages or benefits that you lost, as well as what's called injury to dignity. In compensation for injury to dignity, feelings, or self-respect, that's that kind of psychological impact that the discrimination had on you. In another context, we might have heard it called sort of pain and suffering damages. Compensation for the impact of the discrimination on the person. And the tribunal can also do sort of specific concrete things like order you to get your job back, order a change in a workplace policy, or if it's a collective agreement that's creating discrimination, they might order the collective agreement to be changed. If it's a services case, they might order that the service you were denied be provided to you. Sometimes that happens in complaints against government ministries that are providing services and they have denied people on some basis. The tribunal might say you have to provide that service to this person and other people who may be facing the same exclusion. This is what the part of the form looks like where you fill in that information. This is where you talk about any other proceedings that may be going on. This is where, and as Sarah just said, just looking for the type of remedies that you're looking for. So you don't need to put down the dollar figure, but you could say, I'm looking for lost wages, compensation for these expenses that I had to pay because of the discrimination, and also injury to dignity damages. And step 7 is where you check whether or not you're interested in participating in an early settlement meeting. And after we take a break, Sarah's going to tell us lots more about the early settlement meeting process. And step 8, you let the tribunal know if you have attached any other documents, or if you have told some of your story on a separate piece of paper, you just let them know how many extra pages you've attached to the form. You check here that you confirm that what you've put in this form is true and accurate to the best of your knowledge. And then this last information sheet just tells you a little bit about what happens next. What happens next is that the tribunal looks at your complaint form and decides whether it kind of gets over the first hurdle of alleging something that could be discrimination. And as Sarah mentioned, sometimes the tribunal sends complaints back to people to say, there's just not quite enough here. You haven't showed me that there's a connection between what happened and your disability. Or it seems like some of what you've complained about happened more than 6 months ago. Can you please provide some more information about the timing of these events and why you waited to file your complaint? So that happens in a fair number of cases, but once the tribunal has decided your complaint can be accepted, they'll send you a letter letting you know that, and they'll also send the complaint off to the respondents, the people that you have named or the organization that you've named in your complaint, and that gets the process rolling. And then the early settlement meeting is the first thing that happens, and Sarah's going to tell us more about that. In the event there isn't an early settlement meeting, one doesn't happen, and the respondent files their response to your complaint, and then the process moves along. You have to exchange any documents that you might have with the other side that might be relevant to your complaint, and the complaint gets set down for a hearing. Altogether, the process can take generally at least a year and often longer to get all the way through to a hearing, and probably longer than that to have the tribunal issue its decision. And it'll take even longer than that if there are other what are called preliminary applications that get made. Sometimes respondents apply to have the complaint dismissed completely before getting to a hearing on the basis that they think it doesn't have any prospect of succeeding. So that makes the process take longer as well.
So I'm going to talk about early settlement meetings. And when Laura and I were talking about what we could cover today that would be useful, we were asked to talk about the complaint form and how to complete that. So that's good. And we thought maybe we could just get into one more step of what might happen next. And from my perspective, I'm looking at it as what could people handle reasonably without a lawyer. And so I think filling out the complaint form and getting to the early settlement meeting, you know, of course, easier if you have a lawyer, much easier, but probably also things that maybe with some support you could do on your own, and then you don't have the cost of someone like me tagging along. So the early settlement meeting, you saw that box on the form that Laura was going through that said, are you interested in an early settlement meeting? And as the person that files the complaint, you have a choice. You can say yes or you can say no. Most people, and particularly if you are trying to do this on your own without a lawyer, I recommend that they say yes to that settlement meeting. And I'm going to talk about why you might want to do that. I have on this form, this slide, some features of the settlement meeting, and one is the downside. So the downside to me is the one reason why you might want to check no. And that is because despite its name of early settlement meeting, settlement meetings, in my experience, are scheduled 4 to 6 months after you file your complaint. What that means practically is that the respondent, so the company, if it's an employment issue, doesn't have to do anything in the process at all. They don't have to file a response. There's nothing that needs to be done on their part until the early settlement meeting. And so in my experience, what that means is companies do nothing until the early settlement meeting. And so there may be some situations where your things are more time sensitive, and you might want to say, no, I don't want to do an early settlement meeting. I just want to go straight to a hearing, because it puts more pressure on the company to do something sooner if they don't want to go to the hearing. I'm going to assume that most people would check yes on that box and go to the meeting. And so what happens then is, in the information the tribunal sends when they say, yes, we've accepted your complaint, there's a calendar, and it has, you check which dates you'd be available for the early settlement meeting. And it also goes to the respondent, so the company. And the company also gets that same choice. So do you want to attend an early settlement meeting, yes or no? If the company says no, then you don't have an early settlement meeting. It's voluntary. It's not mandatory. That means both sides have to say, yes, we want to go to the settlement meeting. And then a date is set if both sides agree. A really important part of the settlement meeting is it's confidential. So there's a mediator there who is generally a human rights tribunal member. So they are absolute experts in human rights. They have a lot of credibility. They're really smart, and they're really good at helping people solve problems. And so what they do is you'll have someone there, and they'll say, everything that's said in this room today is confidential. And so what that means is parties can be open to talking about things without worrying that it's going to come back to bite them, or it might hurt their legal case if they are going to go to a hearing. So that's a real asset to settlement meetings, and it really lets people engage more openly in the settlement discussions. The other key feature, and I would say the number one, is they're very effective. I meant to look at the stats. I don't know, Laura, if you know them offhand, but last time I saw them, I think it was more than 70% of complaints are settled at an early settlement meeting. So that's really a lot. Your chances are, if you go, your chances are good that you're going to get a settlement of your complaint. And that's ideal. That's much better than going to a hearing and having to fight it out and maybe winning or losing with an all or nothing outcome. So that's the early settlement meeting, sort of some key features. And I thought it might be helpful too, and this is what I do with my clients, is I talk to them also just about the practicality, like what does that look like from a practical sense? What happens? And so what happens is, usually if you're in the Lower Mainland, they're in person at the Human Rights Tribunal office, which is at Robson and not Robson. Yes, Robson and Seymour. Yeah. Laura's been there more times than me, so that's pretty good. The Blends Coffee is in the ground floor of the building. I do know that. So it's downtown Vancouver, and you go, and you sit in a room that is not unlike this, sometimes smaller. And in that room will be you. If you have a lawyer or representative, they'll be there with you. The company will be there. The company may have a lawyer or representative. And then the mediator is there. Usually, you start all in the same room. And the mediator reads through. There's a mediation agreement that explains it's all confidential. It's voluntary. You can leave at any time. And they kind of go through the rules of the game with you. And then there's generally an opportunity for you as the complainant to talk about what your complaint is about. Now, everyone will have the form that you filed, but there might be more to the story than what's in the form. I mean, there's always more to the story than what you can put in a form. And so I find when complainants don't have counsel or lawyers with them, often they're surprised when the mediator says, okay, here's your chance to say something. And they're sort of like, oh, well, there's my form. So one thing I tell people, if they're going without a lawyer to the early settlement meeting, it's a good idea to prepare something that you might say. This isn't evidence. You don't have to swear an oath. It's just a telling of the story of your complaint. It should be brief. You don't have an hour. You want to spend the time trying to get things resolved. But the mediator is going to be hearing about all of this for the very first time in that room. And so it's really helpful for them if you give them a bit of what it's about. Very important, you will also get to hear from the respondent, so the company, about what their position is. And that's really important because at that point, they won't have filed any paperwork. There won't be a response. Sometimes you don't even know what they're going to say in response. And so it's a really good idea to have a pen and some paper and be ready to listen to what they have to say and take some notes so that you know what it is they're going to say in response to your complaint. At that point, my experience is usually the parties split into different rooms. So there's lots of little cubbyhole rooms at the tribunal's office. Most of them have no windows, which I think is designed to make people want to settle their complaints so they can leave. And you'll be in one room. If you have a representative, they'll be there with you. The company will be in another room, and the mediator goes back and forth. So we call that shuttle negotiations because the mediator shuttles back and forth between the two rooms, and they try to help you get a deal. And so what might that look like? That we call it arm twisting sometimes. Come on, give a little bit more. Can't you give a little more, company? You know, and they're doing the same thing in both rooms, trying to get the parties closer together and also trying to find creative solutions that have some common interest and common ground to them. So when I say the focus is on the interests, not the legal positions, if you go into a mediation and just say, I want everything, I'm going to win, that's not really helpful for a resolution. And same with a company. If they say they don't have a case, they're going to lose, well, that doesn't really move us closer to working things out. And so a good mediator, and the tribunal ones are very good, will help you focus on solutions rather than and just talking about your legal position and work towards a settlement. So at the end of an early settlement meeting, there's a few outcomes that can happen. So one outcome is we have no settlement. Maybe everyone's just sat in their room and talked about why they're going to win. And so we haven't been able to make any progress. In that case, a hearing, they'll move forward and set a hearing date, and it'll be as if that mediation never even happened. Another outcome is you don't settle, but it's obvious to everyone that more discussions are needed and will happen. So sometimes you kind of get things going at the settlement meeting, and then you pick up the discussions later, sometimes directly with the company. Sometimes you can set another settlement meeting. Sometimes this comes up if there's really important information that isn't known that is getting in the way of getting a settlement. So it's like everybody's in the room and we want to make a deal, but we don't know what your wage losses have been because you don't know what your when you got your new job and how much you've been earning. So that might be one example. If there's a settlement, usually that is in a written agreement, and the tribunal is really great because they will help you with that. They have standard forms of agreement that they can help you to complete, and they will generally try to get everyone to sign off there at the mediation that day, which can feel like a lot of pressure, especially if you don't have a representative there with you. The reason why they try to get everyone to settle that day is because they want things to settle and be resolved. And if everyone leaves and goes home, sometimes the next day you feel differently about it, especially if you haven't made an agreement. So I do encourage you, and we're going to go through this, like how to prepare for the early settlement meeting, because it's actually better for you too if it settles and is signed off, because then the company can't change their mind the next day. So it's better for everyone if you can do that. But and one way to prepare for that is to come very prepared to have that final outcome. Sometimes people are surprised that it's like that you're going to actually get a whole deal, like this is done today. And they're not sort of ready mentally, emotionally, or have their paperwork together to get that done. So come prepared, because that is the best outcome. If you absolutely need more time to think about it, or you want to consult with a lawyer about the deal before you do it, you can ask for that time. And in most cases, you will get that time. So you could say, it's Tuesday, I need until Friday. Could you leave the offer open that long so I can think about it, get some advice, consult with someone else if you need to?
And I'll just add there that you can also call our clinic and talk to an advocate or a lawyer at class at the clinic for free to get a little bit of advice if an offer has been made and you're just not quite sure, or if the company has provided you with a settlement agreement that they want you to sign, but it's full of jargon and legalese and you'd just like a second opinion on it, we can absolutely talk that through with you on the phone or set a meeting and help you out.
And sometimes they're actually able to do that right during the mediation.
Absolutely.
You can phone, dial a friend, and you know who your friend is. This one over here. So I thought I would just give some examples of what might be in a settlement. Like, what might you ask for? And I think what that will help is the end of my talk presentation here is how to prepare. So what might you ask for? And I'm given two examples, and I've related them to disability because that's the topic that we're here to talk about. So example one is you're fired because of your disability. That is your complaint, and you're at the tribunal. Your company's there that you used to work for, maybe the supervisor, and you're trying to sort out a deal. What might be in that deal? Could you get your job back? Could the company agree to give you your job back? They could, hypothetically. In my experience, that almost never happens. So if we're talking about an agreement that everyone has to sign off on, no one can make anyone agree to anything at the mediation, it's very unlikely that you're going to get your job back. I get a lot of clients come to me and say, what I really want is the company to admit they did this, admit that they fired me because of my disability, admit that they were wrong. And again, my experience is you're very unlikely to get that. A resolution or a settlement is usually, one of the terms will be the company is not admitting any liability. The company's not admitting they did anything wrong. It's a compromise of a dispute. What all of that means is we're agreeing to disagree and coming up with a solution that lets everybody move forward. Money for wage losses. This is definitely something that is possible to get and is something you should be prepared to talk about. So if you were fired in January, one of the things that the company and the mediator are going to ask is, what have you been doing since January? Have you been looking for work? Do you have a new job? How much money have you earned? Because that helps calculate what your wage loss damages might be. Only you have that information. So if you don't come with that information, it makes it very difficult to have a meaningful discussion about it. you don't have to prove your case at a mediation. You don't have to bring, witnesses. You don't have to have statements. You don't have to bring boxes of documents. But you need to have enough information about things like how much money have you lost? What has this cost you? So that you can have those discussions. Money for injury to dignity. This is another possibility of something you might be able to get at a settlement conference. And again, you need to come prepared to talk about what that might be. What amount might you be looking for? And it may start with the mediator saying, what do you want? Why, you know, they come in the room with you and say, okay, we're here. How can I help? What do you want? And so if you don't have any ideas of what you might want, it makes for a very difficult mediation. Reference letter. I was just trying to think of things that I sometimes negotiate for clients, and reference letter is another part. So if you worked there and you did a good job, you may be able to get agreement for them to provide you a reference letter so that you can then use that to help move forward to your next job. So a second type of disability discrimination complaint you might be at the tribunal dealing with is where accommodation has been denied. So for those of you that were here last time, Laura and I did a little role play about lights, and I had a disability, then the lights impacted me differently than everyone else. And so I was asking Laura as my boss to do something about the lights so that I could continue working there. Well, if Laura had refused, she agreed because I was so persuasive, but if she had refused to fix the lights, I could file a human rights complaint and say, I have a disability. I think my example was I had a head injury and that the lights were aggravating that, and the company failed to take reasonable steps to accommodate my disability. And so I could file a human rights complaint about that even while I was working there. You don't have to not work at a place anymore to file a human rights complaint. Of course, I think the example over here about retaliation is a real concern if you're filing a human rights complaint somewhere that you work. And so for that reason, it doesn't happen very often, but you can do it. So if we're talking about an accommodation that's been denied, what kind of solutions might we be looking at? Again, apology, admission of guilt, very unlikely that you're going to get that as part of a settlement or resolution. Creative accommodation solutions, that is definitely something that you could be there and be ready to talk about. The other thing that I find once there's a dispute between a company and an individual, the company is usually quite happy also to talk to you about an exit agreement where you would no longer work for them and they would pay you some money to move on. That doesn't solve the problem of the accommodation, but sometimes it can be a practical solution that lets you move on with your life from there.
One possibility that I have seen happen, and I'm not sure if it's increasing or if I'm just seeing it happen more than I have before, is where the complainant would really like for the company to get some training about its obligations under the Human Rights Code. 'Cause a lot of time people want to ensure that what happened to them doesn't happen to anybody else. And so that's something that you may be able to negotiate through a mediation as well. And in fact, they might even come to our clinic to ask for that training, and we can go to workplaces and provide some anti-discrimination training.
That's a great addition to my list here, and sometimes to a policy. Like if they don't have a policy dealing with the issue, training is definitely something that can get discussed. No one in a settlement meeting can force anyone to agree to anything. So you have your full rights. In the end of the day, you can walk away and say, no, you know what? I'm not willing to agree to those terms. And the company has the same options. They can walk away and say, no, I'm not willing to agree to those terms. In something like 70% or more of cases, and I wish I had the number, terms get agreed to. People find resolutions. And most people who are at the early settlement meeting, it's because they want to find a solution. And that's why they're there. Practically speaking, how that probably would have played out is I would have said to Laura, look, given my whole spiel about my disability and how the lights were impacting me, suggested all these resolutions. If she had been not an unkind and ignorant person, she would have said, no, the lights are the lights. You can't, that's your problem, not my problem, right? Well, probably what would have happened is I would have probably gone on a medical leave because I couldn't have stayed there with those lights. And so I'm on a medical leave. I'm still an employee. I'm still on the books. I still work for the company. I'm not going to work every day. So from a practical perspective, that's probably how that would play out, is you wouldn't physically be at work. And you can see how the delay in the 4 to 6 months to get to a settlement meeting might be an impediment as well. But practically speaking, that's probably how it would happen. It's very unusual for someone to have a human rights complaint while they're still working. I can think of one example that was a case both Laura and I worked on where someone did, and it was about a promotion that they didn't receive. And they filed a human rights complaint, and they were able to continue working in their existing position through grit. And also, in the company's defense, they didn't retaliate at all. And so they were all able to keep working together pending the outcome of the complaint. Doesn't happen very often, but it can. So those are some examples. And as I've said, one of the reasons I wanted to give you those examples was so you can see what kinds of things you want to prepare so that you're there and ready to talk about it with the idea that you're going to settle it and be done with it at the end of the day. I mean, imagine that. These situations are so tense and so stressful. And so that relief you get when you're able to come to an agreement and let it go is really valuable. I purposely didn't say an apology was impossible or never happened. I said it's unlikely. And so there are some circumstances where companies apologize. I act as a lawyer for companies and individuals, and I will certainly encourage companies, and I'll tell them it's free. It's free to apologize. It doesn't cost you a dime. You can choose what you say and how you say it, and say something that's meaningful to you and that you're comfortable with. It can be very powerful. That can really change the dynamics. And it does happen sometimes. Yeah. But I never send people as a complainant into a settlement meeting with that as their goal, because it's just chances are you're not going to get that. But you're right. But I think when I do go with clients who have been discriminated against and they don't get an apology, what they'll say is, you know what, that money that they paid me, because generally there's some money that gets paid, that shows me that's the sign that I needed, that is an acknowledgement on their part that something happened here that shouldn't have. Otherwise, they wouldn't be paying me. And they can say left, right, and center, we're just paying you because this is a nuisance and we want it to go away. But I know what happened. And so I can look at that money and say that gives me the satisfaction of, you know, some kind of outcome. And in the end, you know, what's fair for a settlement? I get that question all the time. What's fair? And I say, what we can look at comparable cases, you know, we can find parameters, but at the end of the day, it's what is going to let you close this chapter and move on with your life. That's the test. And sometimes that's an apology. Sometimes that's money. Sometimes you might go in hoping for one, but get the other. But that's what we look at the end of the early settlement meeting. What are our options? Accept the settlement, close the chapter, move on with my life, or don't accept the settlement, move on, fight it out at a hearing. So early settlement meetings, how to prepare. So number one thing is, as I've described the day and it's going to unfold, you want to have prepared a little statement outlining the complaint, just like you're talking to me, to say, hey, what happened to you? Tell me in your own words, because that's going to be way more impactful than reading it in off the complaint form. Think about what you want as an outcome and even come with a list. You don't have to give anyone that list, but that list you can have for yourself. Like, these are the kinds of things I'd like to see out of this. If wage loss is possible, so if you lost your job or you were put out of work because of the discrimination, know what the number is. Know how much you would have earned since you were let go. Bring records. So you don't have to bring all your documents, but if you have a hire letter from your new job and some pay stubs, that'll really help, because you're going to have to try to figure out with the mediator what the right amount is. And this one is really important. Prepare an impact statement. So what won't be included in your complaint form very well and what you could never articulate in the complaint form effectively is how this has impacted you. And so the mediator is going to ask that question, how has this impacted you? And that can be so powerful to say, especially if you can say it with the company in the room. So personal impact, impact on your family, health, financial, the whole picture of what this conduct meant for you, because the company won't know that. And so that can be the turning, you know, the TSN turning point in these things, right? Because we're all people. And so to hear that, don't embellish it, don't exaggerate, but if you can say it in a way, again, that you would say to your friend, this is how this has hurt me, that can be really effective in a mediation and really important. And it's, if you aren't prepared to say that, boy, is that hard to come up with on the fly. Because you tend to focus just maybe on one thing that happened, but if you can really back up and think about all the things, that's important. And what you use that impact statement to do, well, one is to soften the company up to give you some more money or something that you're looking for. But two is to quantify injury to dignity. So after I'm done here, if we have time, which it looks like we probably won't, but on the BC Human Rights Tribunal website, there's a section called remedies, and it has in it examples of injury to dignity, because how the heck are you supposed to figure out how much that would be worth? I still don't really feel like I know, and I do this every day. You know, and it will say things like 50% of complaints get $5,000 or less here. And so right away, you know, okay, unless this has had a really serious impact on you, probably you're looking at $5,000 or less. What kinds of things would be serious enough to get more than that? There are some examples given on the website that show, and you can say, okay, do I think I'm in this ballpark or do I think I'm in that ballpark? And bring creative ideas and an open mind. So the example I gave of the mediation that didn't settle because each party sat in their room and talked about all the reasons why they were going to win and they wanted everything or they were going to give nothing, you're not going to settle. So come with some ideas, but also come with an open mind to ideas that the mediator might have or ideas that the company might have. If you go in with, you know, go in with a list, but don't, you're not married to that list. You need to be able to be flexible and move around and think about creative solutions, because that's where the magic of settlement happens sometimes, is in the creativity. Another way to prepare is to review the resources on the Human Rights Tribunal website. So there's a lot of really good information on there. There's going to be even more amazing information once the Human Rights Commission gets their hands on that website, I think. But even now, there is good information on there. There's a whole section on settlement meetings. And so read through that and use that to prepare. Consult with a lawyer. So I am very expensive, and to have me come to the mediation with you for the whole day, you pay. I'm the most expensive taxi in the world. So it's going to cost you a lot, because mediations can take the whole day. You can be there for 8 hours. They're generally set for half a day, but my experience is rarely are we done by lunch sometimes. So if you're paying a lawyer hundreds of dollars an hour to sit there for 8 hours, that's going to be a lot of money. I have clients sometimes that will come to me and say, I've got my complaint's been accepted. I've got an early settlement meeting scheduled. Can I come and sit down and talk with you about how to prepare, what might be reasonable to settle for? And I love doing that and empowering people to, with information, to go in and settle it. You don't need me there holding your hand. What you need is information that's going to let you know what's reasonable so you can approach that with confidence. So I do that. If you're calling lawyers and it's someone other than me, it's called a limited scope retainer. So I'm not taking on the whole file. My name's not on it. You're coming to me on the side for one little bit of advice. And that's a really cost-effective way to get legal advice. At the early settlement meeting, arrive on time. Don't be like me and arrive late. That said, if you are a few minutes late, it is not the end of the world. They're informal processes. The mediator is not judging you. They don't get to say yes or no to your complaint. They are just there to help try to get a solution. So if you've offended them by showing up 15 minutes late, well, it's not ideal, but it's also not a big deal. But it's a stressful situation, so it's better just to be there on time and be organized and prepared. The mediator isn't making decisions, but what they're doing is collecting up information they're going to use to pressure the company to give you something more. And vice versa, they're getting information from the company that they're going to put to you to try to pressure you to settle. So the more things you can give them to help convince the other side that they might need to resolve this, the better you're going to be. And if you're organized and prepared, it makes their job really easy to help you resolve things. So this, I believe, is Laura's section on resources. So I'm going to let her take back over. You have 4 minutes, sorry. And yes, if anyone has any questions, catch me on the way out. It's been a pleasure speaking with you guys. It's been a highlight of my week.
I'll just quickly go through a few resources that I wanted to make sure I flagged. Does everyone have a copy of the document that has a list of a whole bunch of resources? What I hope you'll find useful about that document is that it's categorized by the kind of issue that you might be dealing with. And those are mainly legal resources, as are most of the things that I'm going to talk about here. I won't spend too much time talking about the clinic because I've talked about myself enough, I think. You have a sense of what we do. We provide free legal services to people at all of the stages of a human rights complaint. And we've looked at the tribunal website. I encourage you, if you are proceeding down this path, to explore the website and check it out. It's maybe not organized as well as you might hope, but if you kind of play around and dig around, I think you'll find a lot of pretty helpful stuff, including information about the early settlement meeting. There's a whole guide, and actually the guide about settlement meetings is in a couple of different languages besides English, so that may be helpful for some folks as well. The lawyer referral service is a place that I refer people to pretty often. They provide a half an hour of legal advice with a lawyer for $25. Now, half an hour is not a long time, but if there's something really particular that you need some advice on, something you're dealing with in the moment that you don't want to go to the Human Rights Tribunal about right now necessarily, but you need some clarity on a legal question, this can be a really good resource to call. So this is the Canadian Bar Association, the CBA's lawyer referral service, and you can call them up between 8:30 and 5 and get a half an hour of legal advice for $25. Access Pro Bono is another really amazing resource here in Vancouver. Access Pro Bono has what they call a roster of lawyers who are doing work in all sorts of different practice areas, so all different kinds of law, including employment law and human rights law, family law, real estate, all sorts of different things. And if you give Access Pro Bono a call and say, I'm dealing with this problem, can you please match me up with a lawyer? They will try to find a lawyer working in that practice area who's able to help you. They do have an income threshold, so only people with an income below a certain level are able to qualify for a free lawyer, but it's worth checking them out. That's Access Pro Bono, and that's on your list. Do folks know about Disability Alliance of BC? Spring's nodding, a few other folks are nodding. So they're a great advocacy organization. I don't know that they have a lawyer on staff, but they certainly have advocates, legal advocates, that can provide all sorts of assistance with different issues, from getting disability assistance to dealing with tenancy issues and pension issues and all sorts of different things. So they're a really great resource for advocacy and support. We wanted to talk about one resource that's not exactly a legal resource, but that is something that I bet Louise knows a lot about, Work BC. And you could probably talk about it with a lot more expertise than I can. Are you able to share a little bit about what Work BC does? Like, just what do they do? Why might somebody reach out to Work BC? So a resource to know about, and maybe talk to Louise about them if you're thinking that they may be able to provide you with some assistance to just get a bit more information, or
I think I have two more. PAVNet is a network of advocates. And these advocates are based in sort of community-based organizations across the province. And I highlight this resource mainly because it serves everywhere in BC. And you can go to the PAVNet website and punch in where in the province you are, and a list of advocates pops up. You can also search by the kind of issue that you're looking for assistance with, whether it's a disability issue or a housing issue. You can also search specifically by issue. So this can be a pretty useful resource to find service providers outside of Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. Because so many of the resources, of course, are concentrated here. And the last one Sarah told me about last week is a very cool looking resource called Ask an Advocate, and it's based out of Sources, which is a service provider in Surrey. And again, these aren't legal organizations necessarily. The advocates can help with some legal issues, but mainly they're helping people with disability assistance, EI applications, maybe some residential tenancy issues, disability programs, and so forth. But they have a real wealth of knowledge. And my experience with advocates is that they're incredibly knowledgeable and incredibly dedicated and really want to help folks that walk through their doors. Thank you for that. And thank you all for your participation over the last four sessions. It's been, as I said at the beginning, a pleasure to be with you. And we wish you all the best.